I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up, we share three stories of people leaving their homeland all for different reasons. We'll hear from poet Richard Blanco. He was raised in a Cuban family living in exile, eventually becoming not only the first Latino inaugural poet, but the first openly gay one as well. We'll also listen to my conversation with Melissa Fleming, chief spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, about the journey of one Syrian refugee fleeing her war-torn country. But first, we'll hear about the Irish revolutionary Thomas Francis Marr, who became a hero of the Irish uprising during the Great Famine before coming to the States and fighting in the Civil War. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. We're focusing on stories about people fleeing their home country to pursue a better life. And we'll begin by learning about Thomas Francis Marr, the Irish revolutionary who led an uprising against British rule during the potato famine, eventually ending up in the U.S. to lead the Irish Brigade in the Civil War. Reporter and author Timothy Egan chronicled all of this in his book, Immortal Irishman. Let's listen. You know, as I was reading the book, I kept thinking, why don't I or we know more about Thomas Francis Marr? He's born in 1823, a pretty wealthy family, a life of privilege. One of the people that knew him said, this lad could talk.
Right.
He knew five languages. And one could imagine a life of privilege. He could have been a merchant or just sort of lived in the lap of luxury, but not him.
Right. And he was you have to set the context. He was a rare person of privilege in a country where about 80% of the people were dispossessed. I mean, it was a crime for a long time to speak your native language. It was a crime to own property. It was a crime to practice your faith, Roman Catholicism. It's a crime to play your sport of hurling. They arrested people who played the harp. Queen Elizabeth outlawed the Irish instrument. So they'd done all these things to deculture these people, sort of a template for apartheid, essentially. And Marr was the rare exception, because his family had gone to Newfoundland, which was the first English colony. And you know what the Irish did the minute they arrived in Newfoundland? They established a hurling club.
Of course.
Because their sport had been outlawed by the Brits. And when the father comes back, the grandfather actually, he is a man of wealth, a merchant. And Marr is this good-looking young lad with a superb education. He went to this Downton Abbey-style heap in England and could have had just nothing but a life of leisure ahead of him. But he always was sort of a rebellious spirit, and he's found the life fake. You know, he's called it imitations of English life, these phony aristocrats. And what radicalizes him, literally as he comes of age, when he's done with his schooling and arrives and his father says, you can take over the business, and he doesn't want any of that. He goes to Dublin, falls in with this group of intellectuals and poets, and they were all lovers and writers. They were young people in their 20s.
Sure.
And full of hope that somehow they could free Ireland, you know, because it was totally under English domination. And the famine happens. And that's what radicalizes him.
Well, you say some really fascinating and frankly really disturbing things about the famine. First, just when we think of it as the potato famine, and
right,
many people died, some starved to death, many people left Ireland because of that. But you're saying it's much more complicated than that and implicates the British.
Right. And that's the conventional wisdom view right now, pretty much. The British didn't start the famine, let's be clear on that. But after it had gotten underway, they certainly didn't prevent the masses from dying. Or they made a half-ass effort in a couple ways with these soup kitchens, which, you know, in some cases you had to give up your religion to go. That's why to this day the Irish will say, you took the soup.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it means you gave up, you swapped your faith out to have 600 calories of warm broth. But let's just back up for a moment. A famine, as it's known in Ireland, the Great Hunger, is the signal event in Irish history, in the same way the Holocaust is for Jews. 1 million Irish died in 4 years' time. 1 million people died. So you had a population of 8. 1 in 8. Imagine in this country if 1 in 8 died next door to the wealthiest empire in the world. Okay? The British Empire was at the peak of its power. The Union Jack flew over 1 out of every 4 acres in the globe. And they were incredibly prosperous at the peak of the early Industrial Revolution. The potato certainly caused it at start because they were peasant class living off the land. An Irish family of 4 could live for a year on an acre of potatoes. And these spores came over possibly in the boat.
A fungus, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so they would go to dig up their crop in the late summer, and the thing would just fall through their hands. It was a humid, fetid mass of black. So they're starving because the potato's gone. But at the same time, and this is the central point, that these people were dying. Food was being exported at an extraordinary rate. Cereal, barley, beef, pork, grains, things, food grown by Irish hands but not put into Irish mouths. So Marr says, let's close the ports. And his fellow Young Ireland rebels, they said, let's not let this food go from here.
Well, Marr and his fellow rebels, revolutionaries, decide to try to organize and prevent the ravages of this famine. But interestingly, I mean, they were interested in poets.
Right.
Was it the idea that we can use language and literature to try to change this policy?
It's like one of the great quixotic crusades of youth and your belief that poems, you know, sonnets against swords. During the revolution, it was just an uprising. And their idea was that we would move these starving masses. At one point, Marr speaks to 50,000 people, but they were all starving. So I have a chapter called Pitchfork Patties. And they were just scarecrow Irish. That was another term used. And some of them,
because they were so skinny.
Exactly. And there were all these descriptions of mothers dying in a ditch holding their children. And then they take these poor dead children with their bloated faces and their teeth were staying green because they'd been gnawing on nettles all day. It was an absolute – I mean, you can read all the accounts, which are just horrifying, by Quakers from England who said, why are we letting this happen? The Choctaw Indian Nation sent a ship of corn to the Irish, and the Brits initially wouldn't let it land in Dublin Harbor. So he tries to get these people to rebel, and they have no guns. You know, they're pitchforks, and it's an absolute failure. And so they're all arrested. These seven leaders of Young Ireland are arrested, and Marr's sentences to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and his remains disposed of as Her Majesty shall see fit. Her Majesty is Queen Victoria.
Even though he never fired a shot. I mean, he personally never killed anybody.
Thank you for pointing that out. He never fired a shot. He never issued a call to attack. He just said, it's time for us to rise up and throw off the British yoke so we can feed the people. Or at the very least, stop these ships of food, these exports, from leaving the ports and give them to the starving people. There had been food riots. So he went around to these parishes and they never did. And so he's sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered just for his words, his speeches alone.
So Marr ends up at this penal colony in Tasmania, along with thousands of other Irish men and women. Mm-hmm. So what is life like on this penal colony?
Well, it's a very strange thing. This is the Victorian age. So the political prisoners, if they gave a pledge to not escape, they were not put in a cell and they were not lashed with the cat o' nine tails, which is what they did to the common criminals. They had a little district where you lived the rest of your life, 7 miles by 7 miles. You were never supposed to leave your district, but Marr always found ways to sneak over the bridge to have lunch with his buddies and this and that. And they were, again, think of these people in their 20s, and they're all brilliant, and they're all of them that go on to brilliance later. It's amazing things in their lives. And they're in this godforsaken place. I mean, actually, Tasmania is quite beautiful, but then it was called that isthmus between hell and earth,
whoa,
you know, and because it was an active penal colony. They've got road crews where they're whipping him and all this stuff.
But he does escape.
He escapes. And that's, I think, one of the most gripping sections of his life is that it's a 12-day escape, and it's pretty extraordinary. He escapes, and then he comes to New York City in 1852, and they hear of his escape. And the Irish American newspapers are saying, all praise to Thomas Marr. He's coming to America. I mean, so now his status, he's gone from the orator who defied them during the revolution to this man who actually escaped the penal colony. So he's coming to America. And they say this is at the same time that 1.5 million Irish are washing ashore. And literally they're washing ashore. They've never been outside of their villages. And we've got this great surge of immigration we're seeing for the first time in our history. And Marr's destiny is hung on him. He will be the man to unite and guide him. And he doesn't have any idea what that will be.
And this is 1852 when he comes to New York.
Yes.
He is an escaped convict. So it's not like he's a legal immigrant.
He's not in any way. He's a criminal. They send their worst people. You know, he's not, as Donald Trump said, a rapist, but he is a criminal. So so are many of the other Irish, I mean, that are coming ashore. There are people in really bad circumstances who've come and they're bringing disease. There's this typhus on the ships. They call them coffin ships. So they're wretched masses. They really are. And they're living in tenements. Yeah. Some of them are doing well. Here in Philadelphia, they have established neighborhoods. But you're also starting to see some pushback at the same time he arrives, too.
Well, there is this party, the Know Nothing Party, that gets organized because they oppose immigration. Does it have the familiar ring? I don't know.
Just consider this. So we're a nation of immigrants. Everyone here is from somewhere else except for your Native American, which is only 1% of the population. But the first real wave of people who were others were Irish. They were followed by Germans, Eastern European Jews, Italian Americans, people from the Asians, all over the world, of course. But the Irish were the first ones to feel the brunt of what Mexicans are feeling now. And all the things that anti-immigrant people say about Mexicans now, they're criminals, they're rapists, we don't, our culture's getting polluted. You could just drop the word Mexican and put in the word Irish and, you know, call them scum. Here in Philadelphia, they burned down the churches. They had what the Jews call pogroms. They burned down an Irish-American firehouse. They had riots. There was just, you know, huge death. This is the peak of the Know-Nothing. At one point, the Know-Nothing Party is the second biggest party in America.
Right.
And they're running a presidential candidate. They have governorships up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And this is what's amazing about time traveling in our history, Marty. It's the only party, major party in our history that's founded for a single purpose, anti-Irish. Specifically, it's not anti-immigration so much as it's anti-Irish.
So what did they think of Thomas Francis?
So they tried to knock him down. I mean, here's this guy where they're doing these Mar polkas and these Mar clubs are springing up, and he's speaking to 5,000-10,000 people. He's quickly becoming, he quickly does become, let me rephrase it, the best known Irish American. He's giving speeches all up and down, and he pushes back on the Know-Nothings. Here's the problem. He's looking for a way, as is everyone, that the Irish can become American. I mean, they are clustered in these tenements. They are clannish. A lot of them speak Gaelic.
Right.
So Mar's thing is, how can we make them belong? How can they become American? That arrives in the form of the Civil War.
Well, that's so interesting, because he does head up this brigade, the Fighting 69th.
The Fighting 69th, which people know very well in this part of the country. I'm from the West, so... was formed out of the New York militia, mostly an Irish militia, but out of that became the actual formal Irish Brigade. And at the outbreak of the Civil War, there's a real question of which way the Irish would go. Because Frederick Douglass tours Ireland in the famine, and he's amazed, the ex-slave, orator, newspaper man. He says, I find myself treated as a man and not as a color. He was impressed that they didn't see any racism, but he also was appalled by the state of the peasantry. He says only the American slaves have it worse than the poor Irish. Then he notes 10 years later that when the Irish come to America, they start to pick up some racial attitudes that they didn't have when they were there. And it's because they're being told that if these 4 million slaves, remember, Marty, we are the biggest slaveholding nation on earth at that time, 4 million slaves. And they're being told if they're free, they'll take your crappy jobs.
Yeah.
So they're building the sewers here. They're running the rail lines. They're building the canals in upstate New York. They're domestics taking care of other people's children. They're shoveling crap into the river. Those are terrible jobs, but they at least are jobs, and they're told these slaves will take them.
Well, he becomes what, a recruiter for
huge
the,
recruiter. So,
for the
and
union.
It costs him a lot of his loyalty and among fellow Irish. Abraham Lincoln brilliantly names him a general. This is a person with no military experience. Mm-hmm. Names him a general to heading up the Irish Brigade, and they then go off and fight. Some of the most iconic battles in the Civil War, starting with Bull Run, where the Union was routed, but the Irish didn't run. So the cover of my book is a picture of Mar returning triumphantly after the Battle of Bull Run. And that's, to answer your earlier question, that's what starts to allow the Irish to become Americans by their sacrifice itself. And this is Mar's recruiting. He says, this blood sacrifice, and he sticks it to the Know-Nothings. He gives speeches in Boston. He says, look how many people are dying in the Irish Brigade. Don't tell me we're not Americans.
That was my conversation with author Timothy Egan about his book, Immortal Irishman, recorded last year. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from Chief Spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Melissa Fleming, about one Syrian refugee's incredible story. Stay with us.
Oh, sure we never will give in any sort of manner until the South comes back again beneath the starry banner. And if John Bull should interfere...
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We continue our show dedicated to immigrants and refugees by listening back to my conversation with Melissa Fleming. She's the chief spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and the author of a new book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea. It chronicles the journey of one young Syrian refugee, Doa Al-Zamel, and the great lengths she went to escape the ravages of war. Let's listen. You know, there's so many stories you could have told about refugees. Why did you choose to tell Doa's story?
Well, there are 60 million forcibly displaced people in this world today, and I wish I could tell every one of those stories. But Doa's story was one that kept me awake at night and gripped my heart. Because she survived such an horrible war that erupted in her hometown. Her hometown is where the war was sparked in Syria. And also lived the grueling life of a refugee and then made that terrible decision to risk her life again with her fiancé and cross the Mediterranean Sea and be involved in one of the worst shipwrecks on the Mediterranean Sea. I thought that her story of survival, of resilience, of the incredible strength of the human spirit would inspire people and build bridges of empathy towards Syrian refugees.
Well, let's go back, not to the actual beginning, but we meet her in your book. She's a teenage girl.
Yeah, 16.
She's 16 years old, living with her family, living a sort of probably typical Syrian family life.
Yeah.
And then the civil war starts, or the protests begin, and she does get involved.
Yes, hers is the town where the Syria war started. The Arab Spring is erupting around. They're watching on their television screens thinking, wow, well, maybe actually we could also demand reforms here in Syria. And it was a very oppressive regime then as well. And so people took to the streets in peaceful protest and hoping that their demands would be met. Instead, the government decided to crack down on the peaceful protesters. And Doa watched as, their government was shooting down people in the streets. She then joined and also risked her life daily to be part of those protests. But things just kept getting worse and worse.
There was a scene where government military people start knocking on the door. They're looking for people. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the kind of terror that she and her family were living under, and other people, obviously, in this city as well.
It was a daily fear that they might take me. They might shoot me, and soon a bomb might fall on my house. For her father, what made him really decide, and with his wife, we have to get out of here, is that there were stories that that women were being taken and being raped, and he just couldn't fathom the idea of that. He wanted to protect his daughters. He lost his livelihood, and so they made this awful decision. And I talked to so many refugees, and it really is the toughest decision ever, even when they're in danger, to give up their home and cross a border and go into the unknown life of a refugee.
They go to Egypt, they go to Cairo, and it sounds like, at least in the beginning, it was, I don't know if welcoming is too strong, but they found a place to live, they did some work. Life was hard, but they were able to find at least a bit of a life.
That's
for themselves.
Right. At the beginning, and actually they were in on the coast near Alexandria, and they were welcome because the government, it was Mohamed Morsi's government, and his policy was very welcoming towards Syrian refugees, a lot of solidarity. They had people from the government knocking on their doors and bringing food and other supplies. But when the coup happened and President Sisi took over, the whole mood changed, and Syrian refugees were associated with the previous regime.
And the women feeling that they could be sexually assaulted, they could be raped, the kinds of worries that they had in Syria.
Exactly, the similar concerns, and the father. And so, at a certain point, the girls were even afraid to go to school. Doa's little brother was made to sit on the floor with other Syrian refugees where the other classmates were sitting at desks. Mm-hmm. So there were small little things, but really big. When you're feeling like a foreigner, you're feeling vulnerable, you don't really have much money, it's difficult to find a job. My organization, UNHCR, was providing, basic assistance, but, we're always chronically underfunded, and, the governments, the countries neighboring Syria, were taking in so many refugees, there was very little they could do as well. So, it was a big struggle.
There's a love story at the heart of this story. A young man named Bassem sees Doa.
Love at first sight.
Takes one look at her and says, who is this beautiful young woman?
And she wanted to have nothing to do with him. She just wanted to keep following the events. She rejected him over and over again. And he won the heart of her mother.
Well, in fact, it was his idea, Bassem's idea. Mm. He says, I want to go to Europe.
And also, you know, his friends, he was showing Doa on, you know, Facebook pictures from his friends who had taken the journey. They were in Amsterdam, they were in Munich, and they were saying, you know, life was good and they were able to study and they were able to find work. And, you know, Doa was also absolutely determined not to go. She had mortal fear of the water. She had a near-drowning experience when she was 6 years old and never learned to swim. And she had heard also about the people who made it, but she also heard about the people who died. And it took a lot of convincing, but he finally did convince her.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about smugglers. We're talking about thieves. We're talking about rickety boats, overcrowded boats. I mean, everything that would terrify anybody.
Well, these smugglers, of course, are very clever, and they show pictures of, you know, beautiful cruise liners and say, you know, you'll be safe. You know, it costs you only $2,500 each, which for them was a big deal. They just had to really scrape everything together. The whole family pitched in. Doa sold her jewelry. They didn't quite believe that the boat would be a cruise ship, but they were really appalled and frightened when they saw how the boat actually looked. It was an old fishing boat, but they crammed 500 refugees on that boat and 100 children. I mean, among the 500 were 100 children. And so, you know, people were just, you know, shoulder to shoulder, feet to feet, you know, there were no proper, you know, facilities, awful, you know, just stale bread on offer, and people were getting sick. The only thing that held them together, you know, was this hope and the solidarity of everybody in the same awful boat of horror, but that, you know, they knew that their destination was going to be, held a lot of promise.
And Doa wasn't in the greatest health. She had been hospitalized. Yeah. She was frail. Yeah. She was very thin.
Yeah.
So it's not as if she was some robust young woman heading off for parts unknown.
Which makes actually her survival even more incredible. Yeah.
The boat gets rammed. What causes this boat to sink?
Yeah. So, you know, they've been 4 days on the water in this boat, and they start getting, of course, very impatient and asking the captain, you know, how much longer? And the captain answers, in 17 hours, he estimated they would be reaching Italy. And they thought, wow, that 17 hours we can handle. And they even started collectively singing smiling, and the sun had just come out. When Doa looked over her shoulder and saw this boat coming full speed towards them, and when it got really close, there were about 10 men on the boat, and they were shouting just the worst of all insults, holding pieces of wood and throwing it at the boat, and they felt this huge loud bang and realized that they had rammed the boat, and then they turned around again, sped back and rammed again, and then there was a hole in the side of the boat and the boat sank. And of course the people below deck were doomed.
Why did they ram the boat?
I don't think we'll ever know. I don't think we'll ever know. We believe it's part of some smuggler gang. Maybe it was the same gang, and they just decided, you know, we've collected all of their money. They earned about $1 million on the back of these people, and it's not really worth it to us to take them all the way. No one will know. There was never an international investigation into this, and 500 people died. Mass murder.
So she falls into the water. She, like everyone on this boat, ends up in the Mediterranean.
Actually, of the 500 who were on the boat initially, they estimated that there were only about 100 who survived. So many people, below, they just drowned instantly. And so Doa was had never learned to swim, so she was just waving her arms and legs and trying to stay afloat. And her fiancé found her and had found this little child's floating ring, like the kind that we use for toddlers in swimming pools. And she's a slight, 19-year-old, and she gets on this this floating ring with her arms dangling and arms and legs dangling from the side, and Bassam is treading water next to her. And, you know, they're all just praying for rescue, but nobody came. And as one night went by, she's seeing that Bassam is getting weaker and weaker, and he didn't have a life preserver that was keeping him afloat. He was treading water and holding on to Doa, swimming a little bit to keep warm and coming back, and he just started getting weaker and weaker. But at one point on the second day, an old man approached them, and he had this little baby, this sweet little baby named Malik, who was 7 months old, and he came up to Doa and Bassam and looked Doa in the eyes and said, "Please take this child. I have just lost 27 members of my family. We were fleeing Gaza, and I'm not going to survive, and I need you to take her and help keep her alive." And so Doa took the little baby Malik and put her on her heart. And meanwhile, Bassam is starting to hallucinate, and she's saying, "Please, you know, stay strong." And he's saying, "Doa, I am so sorry I put you in this situation. You are the love of my life. But please do everything you can to survive." And then she watched as the love of her life slipped away and drowned before her eyes.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, she probably would have given up too, as she was seeing many other of the survivors do. When they lost their family members, they just couldn't take it and were taking off their life vests and sinking in. But now she had this baby, and she knew that she had to stay alive for that child.
And she ended up with another child,
Another child, too. On the third day in the water, and there were fewer and fewer survivors, family was nearby, a family that she had encountered on the boat that had, you know, a 6-year-old and an 18-month-old. And the mother came to Doa with the 18-month-old and said, "Our Sandra is drowning, and my husband and I aren't going to make it either." And similar words, pleading with her to take little Masa, who was 18 months, and entrusted her with this baby. And so on the third day, she had two of these babies with her, and she's didn't have any water or any food to offer them at all, and the nights were freezing and dark, and the corpses were even bumping into her, and it was just absolutely terrifying. She just did everything she could to console the babies. She sang to them. She just kept rubbing their arms to try to keep them warm, and played little silly games with them. And then on the fourth day, she saw her first sign of hope, which was an airplane in the sky, and she just waved her arms with the other survivors. There were only about 11 then.
Out of 500.
Out of 500.
500.
Yeah.
And eventually a boat. It was a Japanese boat.
It was called the JPO Japan. It was a merchant vessel and huge, huge boat, and she felt like this little speck in the sea compared to that boat. And it was like a chemical tanker going, headed to Gibraltar, and they had been given a radio signal, probably because the plane had spotted the shipwreck. And the captain was saying, "Here are the coordinates, go to that scene." And when the captain, who I interviewed, started approaching the scene, another boat had already been there and radioed to him, "Just give up. There are no survivors, just corpses there." But this captain said, "You know what? I'm not going to give up without one search. I cannot go on until I see for myself there really are no survivors." And so he ordered his crew to turn on all the searchlights and to put down the lifeboat into the sea and to start the search. And it wasn't long before they heard this faint woman's voice crying, and the wind was picking up and it was getting stormy, and the voice kept traveling. So it took almost 2 hours to actually locate her. And when they did, they were absolutely stunned when she lifted this thin coat that she had, that she was covering the babies with, and they saw that she had these two tiny babies, pulled them in. Doa says that she then tried to push away and go drown with Bassam, but they said she was so weak, they just pulled her up into the boat. Yeah.
And this is not a story that she has told everybody. I mean, she told you.
Yeah, it was. It was hard for her. When I met her, she was rescued to the island of Crete, and so was Masa. Unfortunately, little Malik didn't make it.
That was the seven-month-old baby.
The seven-month-old baby didn't make it, and that just broke Doa's heart. You know, 4 days she survived and then made it to the safety of that vessel and was covered in a blanket and given water, but it was just too much for that little soul. But Masa pulled through
Where's Masa today?
She's in Sweden, and she was called, you know, by the Greek doctors, the miracle baby, because when she arrived at that pediatric hospital, she was on the edge of death. But the Greeks are just also not only good at medicine, they're just beautiful people. And they just hugged that baby and sang to her. And she came through with no damage at all to her brain or her body. And all of a sudden, when Doa was recovering and taken in by an Egyptian family, all of these messages started coming in from around the world, from the family members of the people on the boat, because, of course, they hadn't heard from their loved ones for 8 days. And the messages were, Doa, do you know what happened to my father, my sister, my niece? One of those messages came in and said, Doa, I think you saved my niece, Masa.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was a photograph of Masa, and it was from Masa's uncle.
Doa lives in Sweden now.
Yeah.
How is she doing? So this was several years after, obviously, this
near-death
experience, really.
When she was rescued, it was in September 2014, and in January, 1 year ago, my organization, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, was able to resettle her, thanks to the generosity of Sweden, and along with her family, who were still back in Egypt and were being threatened by these smugglers because they were worried that Doa's talking about this incident would implicate them. And so, you know, they were being threatened, and UNHCR was able to get them out of the country. And they're now living in a snowy northern village in Sweden and learning Swedish and going to school and trying to restart their lives.
My conversation with Chief Spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Melissa Fleming, author of A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from Cuban-American poet and author Richard Blanco. Stay with us.
العالم رهدان ويا شوف غير القمر يمشي شرج المحاسن وقاضي بدرب العشرة ما شفت العالم رهدان ويا شوف غير القمر يمشي شرج المحاسن وقاضي بدرب العشرة.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Coane. We continue our show dedicated to immigration with Richard Blanco. He's the fifth ever inaugural poet who wrote a poem and spoke at the second presidential inauguration of Barack Obama. Blanco was raised among a family of Cuban exiles in New York and Miami. His memoir is called The Prince of Cucuyos. And he joined us in 2014 to discuss the book, the characters which permeated his early life, his life as an immigrant, and as a gay man living in the closet. Let's listen.
For all of us today.
You know, I'm thinking to be asked to be a poet at a presidential inauguration has to be not just a daunting task, but you have to deliver something for the entire nation, for a president. You have a gigantic audience, I'm sure one you had never imagined. Just what kind of pressure was that for you?
Well, the pressure, of course, was amazing on many fronts. Writing a poem is always also an emotional endeavor. So one of the big questions I also came across, which I didn't really sort of realize I was going to stumble upon, is in some ways I'm being asked to write a poem. Well, I'm being asked to write a poem for America, but as I explain in the memoir, that question was still sort of a little vague for me, a little gray. You know, I was like, wait a second, am I American? I mean,
I'm not. You knew the Cuban part, right?
I knew the Cuban part, but I was like, have I arrived? is my story sort of the American story? So that was actually part of the emotional process I had to go through, and that was a big leap in the poem, and that was a big jump start for the poem. The other thing was, again, the audience. So if you think about it, as I've thought about it, that poem was really my first spoken word piece, in the sense that it was the first poem I ever wrote knowing that it would be heard before it would ever be read.
And interesting.
So I had 7 minutes to capture the imagination of 40,000, listen to me, 40 million people through the ear before the page. So that was a little sort of groundbreaking for me as well. But right when I'm waiting to be called up to the podium, or while I'm sitting watching the ceremony go by, something magical happened. And that was, I really got sort of wrapped up in the real meaning of that moment, and realizing that moment in every 4 years is really much larger than me or my poem or my, so the ego sort of took a back seat, and actually my nerves were able to calm down. And so the idea that as I'm sitting there, that same question that I had asked before, am I American? Do I have a right to write this poem and address the whole country? As I'm sitting there with my mom, who grew up in a dirt floor home in Cuba, it suddenly dawned on me, it's like, this is the American story, or a big part of it. And everything that I realized, you know, that I represented suddenly became real and true. And of course, until that moment, you're just sort of trying to get there and, you know, not, you know, all the logistics and stuff. So it was the first moment I had to really sit in that moment, and it was just absolutely beautiful and amazing. It should almost be required that every citizen attend an inauguration.
And perhaps read a poem of their own,
yes.
But I was wondering whether, and all the thinking that you had to go through to be this inaugural poet, whether that led to your memoir, because it got you thinking about yourself and where you came from, and I'm sure, you know, interviewed by everyone under the sun that wanted to know about your family and
right.
blah, 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 all of that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the project started a couple years before, obviously, the inauguration, but it's interesting how in the arts and, you know, as I always say, sort of the poems are smarter than I am, or they premeditate, because you're already working on things, and somehow all those questions sort of were already there. And in some ways, I feel as if I have this great script of my life. I mean, let me give you an example. My very first poem assignment in graduate school was, we read some Ginsberg and some Whitman and some Frost, and my very first assignment was write a poem about America. And it became my first poem in my first book. And that arc of questioning my place in America, suddenly being asked to write and read this poem, sort of kept, sort of the end of this arc of understanding about my place in America. And of course, now begins a new arc of understanding my place in America. But so in some ways, all, as I always say, every writer sort of is writing the same poem or the same story over and over again. I think another poet said that, but I'll steal it. And this idea that we're circling around the same obsession. And for me, it's that idea of home. So it's even larger than just Cuban or Latino, but really, what is home to us? And what does that mean? What does that loaded word mean in terms of family, in terms of cultural, in terms of sexuality, in terms of all these different species of information?
Well, as you said, you were conceived in Cuba, born in Spain, grew up in Miami. How much was, even as a kid growing up, and this clearly was a very tight-knit Cuban community, how much was Cuba this almost like a TV show? I mean, that was so real to your family, but something that you had no personal connection with except through them.
Yeah, it was very real. Well, as I call it, my real imagined, you know, there was a real imagined Cuba and a real imagined America as well. We'll do one half first.
Sure.
But the reimagined Cuba, I mean, it was especially poignant because my mother left her entire family in Cuba.
This was 68, right?
In 68, right. And she had 8 brothers and sisters, and I mean, every single last cousin, uncle, aunt. So I felt like I grew up with half a family, but that other half of family was always present in letters that would come every day, telegrams. All those black and white photos that I would sort through, like trying to figure out trying to see someone that looked like me in my family. It was this mysterious world that seemed so real and yet completely not tangible. So, and it was this place where we were from. And the sort of feeling, I mean, the feeling started fading a little bit more, but there was also always this feeling in the exile community that don't get too comfortable because any day we might have to pack our bags and go back because we're here, but we're not here. And it's that you can understand why the question of home and identity mm-hmm. was from the moment I was born was already in the air, right? So it was very, very much a big part of the influence. In some ways, even before questions of sexuality, I already had questions of home and identity because I was like, wait a minute. And then they would call me El Galleguito, which means a little Galician.
A little Galician.
And I'm like, but aren't I Cuban? Because I was born in Madrid. And right. And so in Cuba, anybody from Spain, they call him Gallego, you know? So all these layers. And it was magical. I mean, in a weird way, it was very confusing. And in a weird way, it was very magical because there's always this sense of always on the cusp of discovery of something. Yeah.
Well, I had to laugh when you not just were a fan of the Brady Bunch, but actually thought this is really how the other America, the America that's sort of outside of our community, this is how Americans live.
Yeah, no, certainly. And it was more than just sort of a casual sort of fantasy or anything like that. I mean,
you really thought this is how Americans live.
Yeah, because here's the irony, right? Like, and I think people will get this, but I grew up in a very undiverse community. It's diverse looking from the outside in, but from the inside out, it was all Cuban. So so my classmates from the majority were Cuban-American like me. The grocer was Cuban. The gardener was Cuban. But so was the doctor and the lawyer and the engineer. So it was a whole stratus of the community was Cuban. So I grew up with people just sort of like me, you know. And America, as I think Liz Balmaceda, the journalist, said once, we love living in Miami because it's so close to the United States and you don't need a passport. Right? And it's still like that. You know, it's still that's why they love Miami. It really feels like so close and yet so far.
They brought their own country with them, right?
And it's added, you know, there's layers now of Venezuelan and Colombian and all this. But so how I contextualize America was TV shows, food, which we'll probably get to in a minute, commercials, the really sort of G versions of history books, you know, here in, you know, Franklin and all the rest here in Philadelphia, you know. I mean, really, there's this other, felt like this other Cuba, this other sort of country that I was going go to someday, and really believed that north of the Miami-Dade County line as a child, that every house was a Brady Bunch house. Wow. And that every neighborhood looked like the neighborhoods on TV. And so Miami felt like sort of, I call it like a cultural purgatory. And not in a bad sense, but the sense of a waiting ground between the really imagined Cuba or the really imagined United States. It's like, well, which one's heaven and which one's hell? I'm not sure. But one day we'll go one or the other, you know.
Well, about a minute before our first break here, and I'll have you do a reading after the break. But I'm curious, as a kid, so listening to your parents or family talking about Cuba, was it a kind of a longing to go back? Was it an anger that they had to leave?
My parents were a little bit different as we came in 68, right? There was sort of a middle class, middle to lower middle class immigration later in the 60s. So I didn't particularly grow up with like a lot of sort of hate and stuff, but certainly hurt.
Hurt.
I mean, there's this sense of hurt. Who's to blame or not blame is another question or what. But the idea is my mother didn't have her family. I mean, it just hurt.
And you sensed that. You knew that.
Yeah. You felt that it wasn't even really something that was ever explicit. There was no sort of indoctrinating kind of conversations. But even in the community at whole, and I think that's why I came to poetry, as also to try to capture that elusive sort of just this sense of in between the lines feeling of the community at whole, the sense of hurt, the sense of being lost a little.
Did you feel protective of your parents? I mean, yes, you were embarrassed by them, as all children, as you say, are embarrassed by their parents, but also protective, sort of knowing, perhaps not knowing a lot, but knowing they clearly left something behind to come to America.
Yeah, I think there was it was okay for us to make fun of them or to take advantage of them.
Right.
And there are a couple of moments in the book where that happens, where someone sort of will attack my parents, and we pounce, you know, like, because it's, I think it's, you know, it's universal in that sense. It's like, I can make fun of my parents, but don't you make fun of my parents, you know? And so, and especially in cases where there's, where they're met with some little bigotry or a little bit prejudice, and this idea of when they would speak English, when they had to, a very accented English, which was a real challenge to write in the book and something I really had to negotiate in terms of craft in the book. But yeah, we got very protective because, again, it's this duality. It's like, hate being Cuban, but I love being Cuban. Hate being Cuban, but I love being Cuban. And don't we always have that engagement with our country?
Indeed.
And I think that sort of, you know, I love America, I hate America, you know, one day, you know, and it's this constant struggle of identity and place and connection and how all that fits. For me, and I think for first generation immigrants especially, there's an added layer, which is you're really dealing with two countries again. You're negotiating, you're triangulating a lot more, several more things. Yeah.
But kids have a lot of power under those circumstances, right? You speak the language, you know the culture. As you said, you know, your parents were at your linguistic mercy.
Yeah, yeah. And not just sort of in situations, but even like in school, for example, you know, letters that we'd bring home, like, oh, don't worry about it. We sort of translate. Yeah, it means I'm doing
not
great.
A problem.
I'm doing great.
Right. I am paying attention.
Unless there was
right?
a letter grade or something. My parents never went to teacher parent conferences because, well, if it was a Cuban teacher, they might, because, again, another layer was the social working class family. They hardly had time. But certainly I remember, you know, the few Anglo teachers, well, not even Anglo, God only knows, not Cuban teachers
right,
that I had,
right.
They wouldn't go because they were terrified to speak, you know, have to speak the language. They knew how to somewhat, but they were terrified to. So even sort of not just situations, but, you know, things we'd get around to. I mean, papers from, you know, the IRS, I'd have to, like, you know, you're being audited, Mom.
Is that true?
What does that mean? No, no, I'm just, but no, sometimes to this day, still important papers, my mom would be like, what does this mean? Like, you know, and I'm like, don't worry about it. You know,
everything will be fine.
Everything will be fine.
Your parents named you after Richard Nixon?
Yeah.
True? True?
Well, it's, my dad told me that once, and I've never, after he passed, I wasn't able to ever confirm it. And so the White House actually had caught wind of that. I mean, they had told me, you said this, like, right. Be prepared because the press might ask you this question.
Exactly. But do you like the idea of Latino? I mean, sort of how people from all these diverse and different countries then get called one thing in this country.
Yeah, it's an interesting and sort of wonderful problem to sort of have. And I was just thinking about this last night because I've been in conversation with someone about a TV series sort of
based on this?
Yeah, just a very casual conversation. I don't want to let anything out of the bag. But one thing I was explaining to them that, okay, yes, you know, it's hard to you can't lump everyone together because as Latino groups, we totally get the subtle differences. But we also enjoy other, you know, there isn't the sense that it's completely foreign either. So we do have sort of some sort of common groundwork, especially when we come to the United States, where we kind of face some similar linguistic challenges. If you're the middle generation, that kind of issue, you know, of that sort of has some common ground. But yeah, I mean, it's there's a joke I think in our communities that you say, you know, if you have a room full of Latinos and just Latinos, I'm Colombian, I'm Puerto Rican, and I'm this or I'm that, or I'm, you know, I'm Venezuelan. And then the minute sort of a perceived Anglo or non-Spanish speaking person walks in, we all go, we're Latino. Because in a sense, it's a collective. There is a bond that sort of does sort of connect us.
That was my 2014 conversation with poet Richard Blanco about his memoir, The Prince of Cucuyos. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thanks for joining us, and have a great Super Bowl weekend.